Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Bio 231. It's your only lecture this week, so it's a short week. It's a short week for me. Sorry about that buzz. Because we don't have a lecture on Wednesday, right? Because if we look at the schedule right here, today's the 30th. On May 2nd, Wednesday is your fourth lecture exam on these chapters. Mostly nervous system, but it also goes to heart and, let's see, what, 16? Special senses. All right, so that's what's on the exam. So on Wednesday, bring a clean Scantron that hasn't been mutilated or spindled or written on. Right, make sure it's nice and clean, and a picture ID. Please don't forget your picture ID, because then I can get your grades in the Blackboard right away that afternoon or evening, and we'll be good. Otherwise, we got to fool around. You got to show me your ID, and then I have to enter your grade and all that kind of stuff. Right, so make sure you bring your picture ID on Wednesday. Good pencil and eraser. Anybody have any questions on that? No. Fantastic. Okay, so last time we were talking about the vascular system, and we covered most of the topics, but not exactly everything. So let's just make sure that we cover everything nicely. And I think maybe I'd like this over here and this over here, like that. Okay, and I'm going to describe this slide to you a little bit after I turn the lights down just a bit so that we can see what's happening. Like that. How's that? Too dark? I think you can adjust, right? Just don't leave because I can't tell if you're leaving or not. Okay, and once you sign in, you can't leave. All right, so here we have the arch of the aorta. This is the, what part of the aorta do I have the cursor on right now? What does this look like to you? Ascending, yeah, perfect. So the base of the heart is right here, ascending part of the aorta, then here is the arch, and then here's the descending aorta. How many major divisions does the descending have? Two. Yeah, it's got two. It's got the thoracic division and the abdominal division separated by the diaphragm. Okay, and the first branch off the arch of the aorta, and we see it right here. As a matter of fact, I only see one branch, but remember there are three altogether. This is the brachiocephalic, and we don't say right and left because there is only one brachiocephalic artery, and very quickly it bifurcates when it gets to the level of the clavicle to the subclavian, which goes underneath the clavicle, and then another division courses superiorly toward the head. That's the common carotid. All right, so let's make sure that you know that the common carotid bifurcates right in the neck, cervical region, into the external, which feeds blood to the outside of the cranium, and the internal carotid feeds blood to the brain in particular. So that's a very important blood vessel. And at this junction, notice that there's a little swelling right here that we call the carotid sinus. It's not shown on this diagram, but you should draw it in. Put a lead line in and label it carotid sinus. And in that carotid sinus, there are baroreceptors or pressure receptors. That's one of the main ways that your central nervous system knows what blood pressure you're operating at. And that's a very important parameter. It should vary under very small range, just like your temperature is controlled in a very small range of temperatures. The same thing for your blood pressure. It can be too high, and it can be too low. What do we call too high of blood pressure? Hypertension. That's deadly. And what is too low? It's called hypotension. That's not nearly as deadly, but if it's so low that you pass out, certainly you could hurt yourself, or you could pass out when you're driving on the freeway, and then you could hurt more than yourself, right? Of course. All right, so these are the baroreceptors within the carotid sinus. The other interesting blood vessel that I see right here is the first branch after the common carotid and the subclavian, and that is the vertebral artery. And notice it going through the transverse foramina in the transverse process of the cervical vertebrae. And that one also goes to the brain. So there are two main blood vessels on one side of your body that go to the brain, and that's it. It's the vertebral and the internal carotid. So your brain requires about 20% of all the blood that is pumped by your heart, and it gets there by these two blood vessels. So only four. Hopefully none of those ever misbehave, but the carotid does frequently in many people, and This part of the body right here in the neck is probably the most frequently imaged part of anybody's body in the hospital right here, just looking at the carotid sinus, because you can see how important it is. Okay, let's look at some of these blood vessels that go to the brain. Let me pull the slide up. Some of the blood vessels that go to the brain. Here we are. We're looking at the ventral side of the brain, and I can see the two vertebral arteries here and here, the right and left vertebral arteries. Notice that they join together inside the cranium to form the basilar artery. They join together. Usually, okay, arteries only bifurcate, but in this particular case, they anastomose together. And then here are the two internal carotids, so that's all four of the blood vessels that bring blood to the brain. And if any one of those blood vessels were to become occluded, then some major part of the brain would die, and then that probably would be the death of the individual, because we are really dependent on all of our brain to function properly. All right, so there is a structure that allows blood to take alternate routes, so that if one blood vessel gets damaged, either of the carotids or either of the vertebrals, right, there is a structure that can take blood from any of those arteries and distribute it to the rest of the brain. That should remind you of a nerve plexus, right? So blood can take alternate routes because of something here that we call the circle of Willis. Here is the circle of Willis, and you can see it going right, right above the optic nerves, and then it circles around behind the mammillary bodies, right? So the basilar takes the blood from both vertebrals through the circle of Willis. And we have some parts of the circle of Willis. The posterior communicating artery connects the carotid with the basilar. And then the anterior cerebral artery connects the two carotid arteries together. And then to get back to the basilar, then you would go through the another posterior communicating artery right here. So this circle right here can distribute blood to the whole brain, even if some of these blood vessels are occluded or partially occluded. The two main, of course, are the carotid arteries. If there's 100% occlusion of a carotid artery, then there's going to be loss of function in one side of the brain, but at least it won't die, right? And if that blood flow can be reestablished, then that part of the brain will come back to life just as good as before. All right, so I do want you to know something about that circle of Willis, and on your notes, okay, I think, where is that at? Do I have circle of Willis on here someplace? Oh, right here. Yeah, that's it. So the vertebrals and the internal carotids, right, anastomose to form the circle of Willis, which can distribute blood to the whole brain. Right, so the vertebral artery and the carotid sinus then joined together at the base of the brain to form that circle of Willis. That's an important structure for you to know. Okay, did we talk about abdominal aorta last time? Branches off the abdominal. You know, I got a feeling maybe we didn't, so I'm going to look at it. In lab, I did for a few individuals. Okay, so what do I see on this slide right here? I see the diaphragm, right? Here's the diaphragm. And so that's the separation between the thoracic cavity and abdominal cavity. So what part of the aorta of this is this? It goes from the diaphragm down to this bifurcation into the common iliac arteries. I think you know the common iliacs. But what part of the aorta is this right here? Abdominal. And it's a division of the descending, right? Okay, so I see a bunch of blood vessels that come off of the aorta right here. And it looks a little complicated and messy, but it's not too bad, right? And I'll show you how to take a look at the descending aorta right here. Off the descending aorta, sometimes arteries come off as pairs, and sometimes they come off as just a single unit. And that all depends on the organ that it's going to go to. Some organs you have two of. You have a bilateral arrangement in your body. Like, for instance, you have two kidneys. You got one on the left, one on the right. And therefore, the arteries that bring blood to the kidneys, you have two of. Here is the left renal artery. Here's the right renal artery. So we can look at arteries that come off as pairs. The renal arteries is one example. Here is the adrenal gland, meaning on top of the kidney. These are the suprarenal arteries. And there, here is the right one, and here's the left one over here. That it comes off the aorta as a branch pair. What's another organ that you have two of? Gonads, for instance. Yeah, ovaries and testes. Here are the gonadal arteries that either go to a testes or ovary. All right, so those are the paired branches, the suprarenal, the renal, and the gonadal. That's all you have to know. And then there are some that come off as just a single branch. And here is the first one. And this is what we call the celiac trunk. The celiac trunk, however, when it comes off of the aorta, starts to bifurcate and go to various organs. So we have a gastric artery. We have a hepatic artery that goes to the liver. Oh, where does that gastric artery go? Yeah, it goes to the stomach, right? So when you hear gastric, you should think of stomach. And then there's a splenic artery that goes to the spleen, for instance. That all comes from that first singular branch off the aorta that we call the celiac trunk. And then there are just two more. Here's a superior mesenteric and an inferior mesenteric that supply blood to the intestines, the small and large intestines in particular, right here and right here. All right, so that's all there is to the abdominal division that you have to know. And here's a little tail artery right here, otherwise known as the median sacral artery. All right, what are some structures? Here is a hiatus or an opening in the diaphragm for the vena cava. So this is the hiatus of the inferior vena cava. Here's another opening in the diaphragm. All right, and it's not for the aorta, not for the inferior vena cava, but for a tube that's going to go to the stomach, which is called the, those of you that have had lab this week already will know, right, the esophagus goes through the diaphragm right here, so we call this the esophageal hiatus. That's a hole in the diaphragm for the esophagus to go from the thoracic cavity into the abdominal cavity to empty its contents into the stomach. All right, so that's it for the abdominal division of the aorta. And I think we've covered all of these things in lab, so I probably won't want to go over that. Oh, let's look at some of these blood vessels in the head, like the superior sagittal sinus. So veins in the brain really are not called veins. They're big cavernous chambers that we call sinuses. All right, so a sinus is the same thing as a vein. So which way is blood flowing in a brain sinus? Not a sinus in bone, but a sinus actually inside the brain. Which way is it going to be flowing? Into the heart or away from the heart? So remember, the vertebral arteries and the internal carotid arteries bring blood to the brain. So arteries bring blood to the brain. Sinuses, yeah, are taking blood away from the brain. So those you should really consider as veins. Let's take a look. Let's see if I can find the major sinuses in the brain. Okay. All right, so here is the falx cerebri. This is that big tough part of the dura mater that's in the longitudinal fissure that separates the cerebral hemispheres. And just superior to that is the superior sagittal sinus, built right into the falx cerebri. And then blood flows down past the occipital lobe, where it's going to join the straight sinus, which is coming from more anterior parts of the brain, like right above the corpus callosum. And then it's going to join the transverse sinuses, and that's going to empty blood into the sigmoid sinus right here. So these are all just sinuses within the meninges within the brain. And then the sigmoid sinus drains right into the jugular vein that we see right here. All right, so all of these structures that we see are not veins particularly. We call these things sinuses because they're embedded within the meninges. Okay. So that might be an exam figure. Okay, special circulations in the body. Let's just talk about the usual kind of circulation. Where's the usual kind of circulation at? I guess this is probably pretty good picture of it right here. So So the heart is going to be down over here in this particular diagram, so it looks a little funny. So the heart is pumping blood up in this direction. So let's just think that this is a part of your vascular system. I guess that would be in your head, for instance. That would make sense, right? So the heart is down over here, and it's pumping blood up to the head. So this could be an internal carotid artery. And it pumps blood up into the brain. And look at these arrows. They're taking blood away from the heart. So what kind of blood vessel is this? That's an artery, since it's taking blood away from the heart. Is this pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation? And why would you know? This is, why would you know? Somebody said systemic. Okay, why would you know this is systemic? Because it's taking blood away from the heart, plus one other thing. Yeah, it's red colored. Somebody said red someplace. So it means it's relatively high in oxygen, which is what we would find in the systemic circulation. If this were an artery in the pulmonary circulation, of course, then it would be blue colored, right? Because it would be going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. All right, so I have an artery taking blood away from the heart. It goes through this plexus right here, which is leaky. These are capillaries. This allows for exchange. I don't see any arrows that show exchange, but there is exchange of nutrients and oxygen and CO2 that can happen within a capillary. And then these capillaries join together. What's the name for joining together? Anastomose. They anastomose to form these little venules, and then these veins take blood back to the heart. So how many capillary beds in a typical circulation do we see between an artery and a vein? I only see one capillary network right here. Even though it's complicated, there's only one network in the usual kind of circulatory pattern. Let's look at a pattern that we call a portal circulation. And a portal circulation is right here. Okay, so now the heart is above this diagram. Sorry, that's a little bit complicated, but the heart is above, and here is an arrow taking blood away from the heart, which is an artery. And is it systemic circulation or pulmonary circulation? It's systemic because it's red, meaning high in oxygen. So here is a little arteriole that brings blood to a capillary bed for exchange, and so maybe nutrients and toxins are absorbed in this capillary bed. And what parts of your body might be absorbing nutrients and toxins even that are in your diet? What organs do that for you? Your digestive tract. Your digestive tract are absorbing things that you have in your diet. Right, maybe you had a Coca-Cola, you're absorbing glucose, which is a nice nutrient. Okay, if it's Coke with rum in it, maybe a adult beverage, right, then that alcohol is not a nutrient, it's a toxin. Okay, so nutrients and toxins get absorbed by the digestive tract in these capillaries in the intestines, and then it would go back to the heart, and then the heart would pump it through a couple of circulations to the brain, right, and that would be really toxic. But the capillaries that absorb things from our diet in the digestive tract, right, well, these capillaries will anastomose to form a vein right here. We call this the hepatic portal vein. And when we say hepatic, what organ are we thinking about? The liver, right? Like hepatitis would be liver and inflammation of the liver. So here is a vein that's bringing blood from the capillaries that absorb nutrients and toxins that are in our diet, right? And it brings blood directly to the liver, and then a lot of this blood, right, leaks out of this capillary right here. We call these sinusoids. Remember, that's the leakiest kind of capillary, and it flows around all of these cells that make up the liver, and these cells of the liver get really busy processing nutrients in some respects, but also detoxifying things that are in our diet. Could be pesticides, or it could be things we take, right, because we wanted to, like alcohol, for instance. All right, and then after this blood gets detoxified and processed, it gets resorbed by the capillaries right here, and it joins this structure, which is the hepatic vein, which empties into the inferior vena cava, which takes blood back to the heart. So the liver protects your general circulation from these toxins that we contain in our diet, or at least many of them. So this is an atypical kind of circulatory pattern because why? What's different about this compared to that first picture I showed you? It has more than one capillary bed, right? There are two capillary beds in series or back to back before that blood goes back to the heart. And we looked at that in the special circulation between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. There was the hypophyseal portal system that takes blood from the hypothalamus directly to the anterior pituitary. So it's a special delivery system. In this particular case, the special delivery is of toxins from our digestive tract to the liver, where they're processed before they can have a deleterious effect on our whole body. Right? So, and the vessel, the vein that connects the two capillary beds is what we call a portal vein. And since this one is going to the liver, we call it the hepatic portal vein. All right, so anytime you hear portal circulation, think of two capillary beds back to back. And then functionally, you should know that that's a special delivery system, a special system in your body. So what do we have right here? Okay, here are a couple places where we have a portal circulation. Number one, we just talked about the hepatic portal circulation. There's one in the nephron. And I don't expect for you to know where the nephron is, but, you know, my guess is that maybe somebody in here knows where the nephron is located. Does anybody know where the nephron is located? It's in your kidney. Yeah, so we're going to get into that in maybe the next chapter or chapter thereafter. So the nephron is a second good example. And then the third good example, we've talked about this one already, is the hypothalamic hypophyseal portal system between the hypothalamus and the pituitary. And guess what another name for pituitary is again? It's the hypophysis, right? It's the hypophysis. That's where this name came from. So if we look at the hepatic portal system, we can see that there are capillaries that from the stomach and from around the small intestine, okay, that drain blood into these veins, like the gastric vein, superior and inferior mesenteric vein, and splenic vein. These veins join together to make the hepatic portal vein. And where does the blood in the hepatic portal vein go? Because what does hepatic mean? It means liver. So this blood goes to the liver, and there are capillaries in the liver. So that's the second capillary bed. The first capillary bed will be the capillaries in the intestines. There that blood is detoxified, and then it enters the hepatic vein. That's a vein that's taking blood from the liver to the inferior vena cava, and then that goes to the right atrium, and that just then goes back to the regular systemic circulation. Okay. All right, review fetal circulation. I was going to say fetal pig. I'm glad I didn't. Okay, because it's human fetal circulation that we're interested in. So we talked about that extensively in lab. If you have questions about fetal circulation before the final, then of course you'll have to come see me during office hours or during lab. And you know what? I think fetal circulation is going to be on the last practicum in lab as well, right? So remember those six structures that are in the fetus, and those blood vessels and the placenta are doing the job of the adult lung and liver as well, right? So think of the umbilical circulation as being similar to the pulmonary circulation. It's going to be opposite, right? Which means that arteries are going to be blue-colored and veins are going to be red-colored in the umbilical circulation and the pulmonary circulation. Only in the systemic circulation are arteries red and veins blue. Only systemic circulation. Okay, anybody have any questions regarding the circulatory system? Okay, if not, then we get to go on to another chapter. So I'm going to close this down. Save changes? Okay, sure. Why not? And we can go back up here, go back up. Okay, and I want to open up, lymphatic is opened up already, but what chapter is that? That's 21. Okay, so lymphatic system. So we just looked at the vascular system, and that's not what I want. I'll get this going in just a second. This is good. I forget, where do I usually have these things at? Okay, lymphatic system. Let me zoom in so you can see these things. View, zoom 100%, zoom, page width, okay. Okay, so let's look at the composition, then we'll figure out what some of the functions of the lymphatic system are. We see lymph vessels right here. What did we just get done talking about? What kind of vessels? Blood vessels that carry blood. Okay, and lymph vessels carry lymph, which is a fluid, which is a component of blood. So blood is made up of two different kinds of compartments. Blood has red blood cells in it and white blood cells. That's the cellular part of blood. Sometimes we call those formed elements. And then another part of blood is what we call plasma. It's all the fluid that's outside of red blood cells and white blood cells and platelets. And that plasma has clotting factors in it and nutrients and some gases, okay, that dissolve in the fluid part of blood. Right? And so lymph is very similar to the fluid part of blood. Lymph is very similar to plasma, and plasma flows through your body through lymph vessels. Right, so that's an important part of the lymphatic system. All right, so let's take a look at the whole lymphatic system that I see on this. Oh, I know how I have. I usually do it like this, right? Sorry. Because I want to keep the word slide visible the whole time. And then I flip back and forth over here. All right, so here is the whole lymphatic system, but it doesn't show everything. Where's the whole lymphatic system at? Maybe this one right here. Maybe even a better picture of the lymphatic system. So besides lymphatic vessels, all right, we have tonsils in our oral cavity. One of the functions of the lymphatic system is to fight infection. And so the tonsils fight infection. But what is some irony associated with these tonsils? They're there to fight infection, but sometimes they get infected themselves, right? So that's a pretty nice example of irony. And they can become chronically infected. If they become chronically infected, that means they never heal, and then they have to be removed from the body. That's really the best choice. They don't have to be, but for instance, if they're the palatine tonsils that I see right here, if they're chronically infected, then you're going to have a chronic sore throat. And that might be a bad sore throat where you miss work maybe for a couple of days every week or maybe for a day every 2 weeks or something like that. So it's really costly. So it would be good to get those chronically infected tonsils removed. Right? But usually in most people, they behave pretty well. The thymus gland in the mediastinum is also an important part of your immune system. This is where a special kind of lymphocyte goes to mature. So what we say, gain competence or knows how to fight infections. And since this is the thymus gland, those lymphocytes are called T lymphocytes from the thymus gland. Right? So the T in thymus and the T in the T lymphocyte kind of take the same meaning. These are what we call contact killer cells. Those lymphocytes, when they bump into a bacteria that doesn't belong in your body, they kill it right away by exploding it, by lysing it. So the thymus gland is pretty important. The spleen right here is another important lymphatic gland. And it helps fight infection kind of the same way that the thymus does right here, but it also stores another kind of lymphocyte called a B lymphocyte. And a B lymphocyte can kill not by contact, but at a distance, which is really nice. Right, so if I was a contact killer lymphocyte from the thymus gland right here, I couldn't kill any of you in the room. Because why? Because I can't touch you. Okay. But if I was a B lymphocyte from other lymphatic organs in the body, like the spleen right here, I could kill you because I could release antibodies into the room. All right, so B lymphocytes work by releasing antibodies, but the T lymphocytes work by contact killing. Two different modes of action that keep us in a healthy condition. So here are some other lymphoid tissue associated not with the oral cavity, but with all other parts of your reproductive and digestive system, like the appendix and nodules outside of the intestines, and even within the walls of the intestines are loaded with lymphatic tissue, which can fight infection. All right, so the spleen, thymus, tonsils, and all of this stuff right here, it's associated with the mucosa of the intestines and the mucosa of the oral cavity and reproductive cavity. There, it's there to fight infections. Where are some other organs of the lymphatic system? Okay, I guess I'll go to this picture right here. Well, the thymus will be in this region, right? And then I see some vessels, but these are not blood vessels. These are lymphatic vessels, and they're very much like veins. Okay, what direction does blood flow in a vein? Yeah, blood. So we're talking about a blood vessel that contains blood. Which way does it flow? Back to the heart. All right, so these lymphatic vessels are very much like a vein because they carry lymph in what direction? Back toward the heart, and they empty into the circulation right at the subclavian vein, here and here. So these lymphatic vessels in your fingertips will move lymph into your forearm, and then the arm, and then through the axillary region and subclavian region, and then into the subclavian vein right here, returning that fluid to the cardiovascular system. Okay, and even these major lymphatic vessels that we see in the lower appendage and in superficial fascia or hypodermis in the pectoral regions. Okay, those are the lymph vessels. So let me look at the slide right here. Lymph is the fluid. Lymphocytes are the cells that fight infection. Lymph vessels, tonsils, spleen, thymus, gland. The only thing we didn't mention yet are these nodes, lymph nodes. And I can see aggregations of lymph nodes all over the body. Okay, like in the axillary region, there are a number of axillary nodes that are very superficial. So that when somebody has an infection, for instance, in this arm over here or shoulder, these lymph nodes become activated and they start to grow and enlarge, and they also hurt a little bit, but because they're bigger, you can palpate them with your fingertips in this axillary region. You can also palpate them when they get swollen, when they're in the cervical region right here or inguinal region. So a physician might actually palpate your neck or your axillary region or inguinal region right here because he's checking to see if any of these lymph nodes are enlarged, which kind of signifies that there's an infection in that part of the body, right? And it might be localized to that one region of the body, but if somebody palpates all of these lymph nodes all over the place, what does that tell your physician? Well, then you have a systemic infection that's all over your body, not just coming from one particular location. All right, so these are what we call lymph nodes, and the job of a lymph node is to filter lymph as it flows back toward your heart. And so lymph flows through this lymph node right here, and if there's any bacteria, hopefully the node removes the bacteria from the lymph and destroys the bacteria before it can get into your general circulation. But not just bacteria, but any kind of foreign substance. Maybe it could even be a fungus, or a virus, or other kinds of particles, and maybe even tumor cells as well. Okay, so you might have a tumor growing in your arm, and it's just going to affect your arm, but if that tumor becomes cancerous, those cells break away from the tumor and start to travel through your body through various kinds of methods. One method that cancer cells like to travel from one site to another site in your body is through your lymphatic system, right? And then they may be filtered out by this lymph node, so you might get an accumulation of cancer cells in this lymph node right here, which means what? The cancer has traveled from the forearm into the brachial region or axillary region. That's never a really good sign when that happens, right? Because then you know that cancer is on the move, and it could end up anywhere in the body as a result, and then make brain tumors or liver tumors or bone tumors in other parts of the body. Okay, so the job of these lymph nodes is to filter lymph and hopefully get rid of bad things that are in lymph as it's flowing. All right, so here are some of the important functions listed for you of lymph. Probably the most important one, though these are all important, maintains fluid balance in your body. So what the heck do we mean by that? Fluid balance. Let's see what kind of picture that I might have. Here's a good picture. Okay, so let's take a look at this picture. Here we have the heart. Okay, and then here is an artery, right? It's taking blood away from the heart. It's red. What kind of artery is that? That is a nice systemic artery, right? And so it's going to bring blood at high pressure to this capillary. And remember, what happens in the capillary? Exchange, because there are pores and maybe there's separations between the endothelium so that oxygen can leak out and nutrients can leak out and even some plasma leaks out because these pores are really big. But not red blood cells and white blood cells. The pores aren't big enough for that. So a lot of fluid leaks out of this end of the capillary, the proximal end of the capillaries, because this is high pressure. The pressure dies away as you get to the distal ends of a capillary. So not very much fluid leaks out of the distal end. As a matter of fact, because the pressure is so low in this distal end of the capillary, fluid actually likes to go from the interstitial spaces back into the capillary on this end over here. So usually fluid leaves the proximal end, plasma leaves, or interstitial fluid leaves the proximal end and then re-enters the circulatory system at the distal end right here. All right, so let's take a look at this picture over here. Here we have an arteriole. A lot of fluid is leaking out of the arteriolar end of the capillary, flows between all of the cells that make up your body, right, through that interstitial space, and then re-enters at this distal end, and then that fluid is taken back to the heart so that you don't dehydrate. But here is something interesting. In your whole body, every day, you have 30 liters of fluid leaving your cardiovascular system. Who's got a bottle? Who's got a liter bottle? This bottle is too small. Who's got a liter bottle? That's probably pretty close to a liter bottle. 30 of those things, 30 of that volume, leaves your cardiovascular system every day. So if you were to lose that much fluid every day, what do you think would happen to you? 30 liters is huge. You'd die. Yeah, you'd die in probably less than an hour, okay, if your cardiovascular system were to lose that. And then at the distal end of this capillary, 27 liters get resorbed. So that prevents you from dehydrating. Right, so it flows out, flows back in. How many does that leave? How much fluid then, in terms of volume, is left in the tissue spaces every day throughout your whole body? 3 of those containers. So every day you'd kind of swell up 3 liters, and then the next day you'd swell up another 3 liters, and then another 3, and another 3, okay, and then eventually you just burst like a water balloon, okay? Fortunately, that does not happen because that extra fluid gets picked up by these lymphatic vessels. All right, so 3 liters enters these lymphatic vessels, and where do these lymphatic vessels take all of that fluid? Remember, their veins takes it back to the heart right at that subclavian, right? So right at the subclavian vein right here, all of that lymph from these tissue spaces flows back, enters the cardiovascular system and rejoins your circulatory system so you don't dehydrate as a result of that. The other nice thing is then you don't blow up like a balloon and explode either. Okay. All right, and don't forget, on the way back to the heart, lymph, no matter where it's coming from, has to pass through, come on cursor, at least 1 lymph node. Okay, so if anything that's in those tissue spaces gets picked up, it's harmful to your body, then it's just the job of the lymph node to filter it out and maybe figure out a way to kill it if it's a living thing so it doesn't hurt your body. Okay, and since lymphatic vessels are like veins, okay, what do veins have to make sure that blood flows back to the heart only, doesn't flow back out to an extremity? What do they have? That's right. So the endothelium in veins has valves, and the same thing for lymphatic vessels. All right, so here's a little valve right here, and it's the same processes that draw lymph back to the heart as what draws blood back to the heart through a vein. And there are 2 things that do that. It is the skeletal muscle pump. Anytime you contract the skeletal muscle, that squeezes the lymph, pressurizes the lymph, and it can only squirt which way? Back to the heart. Can't get squirted back down to a peripheral part of your body, as long as these valves are nice and healthy. Okay, and the second thing besides the skeletal muscle pump is the respiratory pump. So every time you decrease the pressure inside your thoracic cavity, not only do you suck air into your lungs, but that also sucks other fluid back to your heart, like blood in veins and lymphatic or lymph that we find in lymphatic vessels. So here are capillaries for exchange in the circulatory system. Here is a lymph capillary. All right, so I see some lymph capillaries. They're totally different. They're similar in the sense that they only have an endothelium, but a lymph capillary is a dead end. And a regular capillary, right, has a proximal and a distal side to it, an arterial and a venous side to it. And these lymph capillaries kind of look like this. If we really zoom in, here's the endothelium. And there are filaments of proteins, microtubules that extend into the interstitial space, and when you move your body around, it pulls on these little fibers right here, and it opens up these little slits in the lymphatic capillary, and these things act like valves. When they open up, the lymph can enter, and when you change body position, they close once again, and these spaces get pressurized, and so lymph starts moving back to the heart. So these things are like gulping all day long. Lymph that's in, or interstitial fluid that's in different spaces between cells in your body, and that fluid then gets put into this lymph vessel right here, and then it becomes, what does that fluid become once it gets through this little mini valve right here? What's this fluid in this lymph capillary? And that is lymph, which is a fluid, which is just interstitial fluid, which is now inside this lymphatic vessel. And where does this interstitial fluid come from? Yeah, it comes from plasma that's in blood that leaks out from plasma in just the normal systemic capillaries. All right, so the job of the lymphatic system is to maintain fluid balance. It removes this 3 liters of fluid from all over your body in different tissue spaces, returns it to the cardiovascular system so you don't dehydrate. So that's probably pretty important. All right, so here is that. Here's that lymphatic vessel picture, and here are some lymph nodes, okay, and we said sometimes the job of these lymph nodes is to filter out cancer cells, so like if somebody does have cancer, maybe in their arm, and they find cancer in these lymph nodes, what would be a good thing to do with this lymph node right here? Yeah, remove it, and when you remove it, you remove the lymphatic vessels. The good thing is, now that cancer has been removed from your body, but what's the trade-off? And a trade-off is usually a downside. It's not a good thing. What happens to somebody when they get lymph nodes or lymphatic vessels removed from some part of their body? Okay, the immune system is, hurt just a little bit, okay? But something that you'll notice right away is that tissue fluid, right, interstitial fluid in this part of your body now can't drain back to the heart. So what's going to happen to this forearm and this hand right here? They're going to swell up. We call that edema, right? So they'll be filled with fluid as a result. But what would be your choice? Have that cancer or have a swollen arm? Probably would rather have a swollen extremity or some other part of your body, but that's always a consequence. Right, and that's why physicians get paid the big bucks, because they have to make those decisions when your body is wide open and they're working right there. Right, so that's called clinical judgment. Okay, because you don't want to take out a lot of lymph nodes, but of course you have to take out enough so that you preserve the life of the person. Okay, let's look over here. Okay, second thing, fat absorption from the gastrointestinal tract. All right, let me see if I can find a picture of that as we're yakking right here. Maybe I only have a picture when we get to digestive system. And indeed, I don't have a picture. We'll have to wait for the next chapter. Okay. Fat. What can you tell me about fat and water? Do they like to mix? No, they just automatically like to separate from each other. So fat doesn't like to dissolve in blood because blood, the plasma in blood, is mostly water. So fats are not absorbed by capillaries in the digestive tract. They're absorbed by special lymph capillaries that we call lacteals, particularly in the small intestine. And then that fat is dealt with. So so that it doesn't form a big plug in a blood vessel and stop your circulatory system. So that's another really important function of the lymphatic system, is that it absorbs fat from food that we eat in our small intestine, so it doesn't plug up our arteries and veins. If we have lymph, which is a watery fluid, and fat, we call that chyle. Fat actually joins with some other molecules, right? And that makes a milky white kind of fluid, which then travels, as it's being processed, travels back to the subclavian vein around your heart. All right, so that's a second important thing. And then the third thing we talked about already, self-defense, the lymphatic system, the lymph nodes filter lymph, the spleen filters blood, gets rid of damaged red blood cells, but it also looks for other kinds of material that shouldn't be in your body, tumor cells or bacteria or viruses. And the spleen and these lymph nodes right here contain lymphocytes, which can fight infection. Okay, and remember there's two different kinds of lymphocytes. There's that B lymphocyte and T lymphocyte. What's a T lymphocyte? I don't think I test you on that. I don't think you have a question on T lymphocytes, but when you get into micro, boy, you're going to spend a lot of time with that. T lymphocyte is a contact killer. A B lymphocyte releases antibodies, releases antibodies. It's new, not too hard to remember if you read about it or hear about it a couple times. Okay. All right, so in many parts of your body, there aren't specific organs, but there is lymphatic tissue that's just part of the organ, part of the reproductive tract, part of the digestive tract. All right, and we call, and one of the linings of these different tracts is what we call the mucosa. I think maybe some of you studied the stomach diagram for the quiz, and you had rugae of the mucosa, that's the innermost lining. Right, it contains lymphatic tissue. It wasn't shown on the stomach diagram for lab, but and nonetheless, this stuff is called mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue, or MALT. And MALT you have all over your body, because what do you have all over your body trying to get in and trying to take advantage of you? Billions of bacteria, right? Because you have all this important energy that they would just love to use so that they can grow and live and reproduce. All right, so we have this mucosa associated lymphoid tissue, or MALT, all over our body, right, including those you could consider this inside lymph nodes and in those tonsils that fight infection, okay, but it's all over your body, digestive tract, respiratory tract, oh, I forgot, urinary tract, reproductive tract, so, and appendix, for instance, so you can lose part of your immune system, like you could have a tonsillectomy, or you could have a splenectomy, or an appendectomy, and lose some of that lymphatic tissue, but you're not going to be really more prone to infection, because where do you have lymphatic tissue? All over your body. And those other parts of your immune system will take over for doing the job of some of these organs if it's removed, okay, by your choice, because it's misbehaving. Like somebody that's missing an appendix is not really more prone to infection. If somebody's missing a spleen, however, that's a much bigger organ, you might be more prone to infection under certain circumstances. One of the considerations you always have to realize is with any surgery, there's always a high risk of infection compared to when you're at your just normal everyday life. And if somebody is missing their spleen, they're going to be much more prone to infection post-surgery, and especially if the surgery leaves something implanted in your body, like a prosthesis, if you need an artificial hip, or if you need screws to hold bones together or something, and you have a splenectomy, then that's always a major consideration. Okay? Okay, lymph vessels. I think we talked about them already. Begins with what? A lymph capillary, just a simple squamous epithelium that we call an endothelium. And then these lymph capillaries join together to form lymph-like vessels. And what would these vessels look more like, arteries or veins in your body? Veins, right? They're really thin. This is very low pressure. They don't need to have a lot of muscles around them. And the other reason why they look like veins, because they have valves, just like veins in your body, to prevent retrograde flow. And when I say retrograde, what does that mean to you? Okay, maybe I won't tell you. Okay, look that up. If you don't know, okay, Google it. Not during lecture, though. Okay, and that lymph then travels back to the subclavian veins via the skeletal muscle pump. Right, the respiratory pump changes in the thorax, pressure changes in the thorax during breathing, and then one other thing that veins typically don't have. Right, and there are smooth muscles in lymphatic vessels that act like little pumps that pressurize lymph, that squirts lymph back to the heart. Typically in a blood vessel vein, that kind of action does not exist. Okay, there is smooth muscle in veins, and these can dilate or contract. It can dilate a vein, and it can act as a reservoir for blood, and then if all of a sudden you need a lot of blood, maybe you start exercising, that vein can contract. All right, but it just returns that blood to the circulation rather than acting as a pump compared to these smooth muscles that are in veins. All right, so let's look at the system of lymphatic vessels. We talked about the superficial aggregates of lymph nodes. Remember, lymph has to flow through at least one before it gets back to the subclavian vein right here. But when I look at this guy, I see two main colors on him. All right, so here is the right side of the body. Here's the left side of the body. And I see that the right upper appendage and right thorax and right side of the head all have one color, and the rest of the body is another color, a darker color. What about this right upper quadrant right here? What color does that look like to you?
Green.
What about the whole left side of the body and the right lower quadrant and right lower appendage? What color does this look like? So I got green and I got
red.
Okay, I'll just say red. Okay, light red. All right, so notice that red covers most of the surface area of the body. So here is something, okay, that we first saw in the cardiovascular system, and that is some asymmetry. So there is one lymphatic vessel that drains lymph from the areas that we see colored in green to the right subclavian vein right here, and we call that the right lymphatic duct. So here is the right lymphatic duct, right here. This is the right lymphatic duct. Drains everything from the right side of the head, the right arm, and the right upper quadrant. The lymph from all other parts of the body drain into the thoracic duct. Right, so everything on the left side and even some major portions of the right side drain into the thoracic duct, and then that drains into the left subclavian vein. Here is the cisterna chyli, which is right at the most distal end of the thoracic duct. Okay, and I don't see any lymph nodes in the thoracic duct. The lymph has already been filtered before it gets into the thoracic duct over here. So this is a funny kind of symmetry pattern that we see. All right, so the right lymphatic duct drains lymph from the right upper limb, right half of the head, neck, chest, right? But the thoracic duct drains lymph from everywhere else in the body into the left subclavian. So that's kind of interesting. Okay, what about some organs? Let's look at some organs. All right, so lymph organs contain lymphatic tissue composed of lymphocytes, that's a kind of white blood cell, a macrophage, which is a monocyte, that's a kind of white blood cell that helps fight infections. Right, and other kinds of cells that have to do with immune response. Most of these come from white blood cells. All right, and remember, lymphocytes have those T and B lymphocytes. Lymphocytes originate in red bone marrow, and then they're carried by the blood to the lymphatic organs where they set up shop, they crawl out of the blood vessels. And foreign substances in your body, like microorganisms, right, when they're filtered by the spleen or lymph nodes, right, they stimulate lymphocyte cell division. And so that is just by mitosis. Right, so at one point in time, you have one B lymphocyte, and then after it goes through mitosis, how many do you have? You got two. And then how many do you have?
Four.
And then you got eight. And then 16. Right, so we call that exponential growth. So the size of these organs grows very rapidly. And we call these germinal centers because these cells, these cell lines are starting to grow. And then they also have a tendency to pass information on between them on how to fight the infection. So maybe you have one cell that can fight an infection that's all over your body. How efficient would that be if you have one lymphocyte that can fight billions of viruses that you have in your body? Not much chance, right? But after that virus stimulates your immune system, now you might have billions of immune cells that can fight infection, and then you're going to get over that infection and go back to your normal daily life. So since these cells are growing, we call them germinal centers. Like germination is when a seed comes alive. When a seed comes alive, what does it start to do? It starts to grow by mitosis, right? Same thing with lymph nodes and other different centers in your body, like the tonsils. This is what we call immune system activation. If you don't have an infection, your immune system is quiet. It's not doing anything. As soon as you get an infection and your lymph system knows about it, it becomes activated by growing contact killer cells and producing antibodies to fight that infection. So immune system activation is the process where these germinal centers become activated within what? Lymph nodes, tonsils, and what? MALT. All these lymphatic tissues all over your body. Okay, the tonsils. They protect your body against pathogens trying to enter your body through your nose and mouth. So they're positioned in your nose and mouth. They contain MALT. Right, and here are the three kinds of tonsils that you have. The palatine, which you can see in the mirror. They're right in your oral pharynx. Right, the pharyngeal tonsil, they're in the nasal pharynx. You can't really see those. Those are adenoids. Those become chronically infected, but pretty much not as consistently as the palatine tonsils. Some people get adenoids removed, but it's most commonly the palatine tonsils. And then the lingual tonsil is on the posterior tongue. I don't think you could see that unless somebody really yanks on your tongue and pulls it out of your mouth. Okay, and when they become chronically infected, then they have just little pockets of white pus all over the place, right? So you can tell very, very easily that they're chronically infected when that happens. Then they should be removed. And for a young kid, that's a fairly easy procedure. A young kid will be eating ice cream maybe that same day or the next day. But for an adult, right, it's a fairly serious procedure. And I believe you still get insurance coverage to stay away from work for 2 weeks. That's a long time. But it won't be a vacation because you'll be really miserable, right? Because your palatine tonsils are about as big as the tip of your little finger. And if you put a hole like that size in your body anywhere, that's going to hurt really bad. It's going to be really sore for a long period of time. All right. But that's a pretty reasonable trade-off because when somebody has a chronically infected palatine tonsil, you might have a really bad sore throat every couple of weeks where you miss a day or two of work every week. So when you get those tonsils removed, that will really change your life, right? So that's a worthwhile thing, even though you have a significant downtime after you get them removed. It's still a worthwhile surgery to do. Okay, lymph nodes. They're small round structures along lymph vessels. Lymph passes through at least one before going back into a vein. You've got these superficial aggregations in the inguinal region, axillary region, cervical region right here. And the job is to filter lymph and produce lymphocytes. And a lymph node will become activated when it's presented with an antigen or a cell that doesn't belong to your body. All right, so activation of the immune system is the same thing as lymphocyte cell division. And when you start with one lymphocyte and then you have two, those lymphocytes are growing. We call that proliferation sometimes. Proliferation is when you have one cell going to 2, then 4, then 8, then 16, right? So lymphocyte cell division or proliferation when the immune system becomes activated, right? There are other kinds of cells like macrophages. Macrophage just means big eater. It's a monocyte that has left the circulatory system and has gone into the part of the lymphatic system, and there it works by phagocytosis. So when it bumps into a bacteria, it phagocytizes it. It doesn't kill it by using antibodies. It doesn't kill it just by contacting it and blowing up the membrane, but it surrounds that bacteria, engulfs it inside of a vesicle inside the cell, and then it combines that vesicle that has the bacteria with a lysosome. What's a lysosome? Anybody remember what a lysosome was? Ah, that's from like the very first week of the class. It's way too long because this is almost the last week of the class, but not quite. Okay, a lysosome contains digestive enzymes, right? It's the intracellular digestive system. So now that bacteria gets digested inside the cell by the a macrophage. All right, and I think you do have a picture of a lymph node as a study exam or an exam figure. So here I can see a number of lymph vessels, right? And so we call these afferent vessels because they bring lymph to a lymph node, just like an afferent neuron is bringing nerve impulses to the brain. That's an afferent nerve. What about an efferent nerve? What is that doing? It's taking signals away from the brain, right? That's an efferent or motor nerve. So here are some lymphatic vessels that are taking lymph away from the node. So these are what we call efferent lymphatic vessels. So in this particular example, if you want to remember afferent and efferent, just think of a lymph node as being like the brain. Okay, because it doesn't think, but it is sort of thinking because what is it doing? It's looking for foreign substances and figuring out a way how to kill those things. So it is sort of like the vein. It's sort of like the brain. I'm sorry. And here you can see some valves. Make sure that you know that flow can only go in one direction across a valve. So the deep part of any organ is what we call the medulla, and the superficial part of any organ is called the cortex. So here we see the cortex. The deeper parts are what we call the medulla. And lymph, when it flows in, just trickles around all of these different cells, right? The very outermost layers, the connective tissue capsule, that's not an active part of a lymph node, but these inner parts are. All right, so we see the germinal center right here. This is where lymphocytes become activated. And so this whole structure is what we call a follicle, and the germinal center is right in the very center of it. And lymph is flowing through all of these things before it leaves these efferent lymphatic vessels. Okay, another organ is the spleen. And we talked about the spleen a bunch already in certain parts of the class. Histologically, we looked at it. So here is the spleen. It contains reticular fibers. What are some other fibers that you know about? What are some other fibers? Fibers. Reticular fibers is one. What's another one? What's another kind of fiber? Collagen. Yeah, collagen. What makes collagen? What kind of fiber is collagen? Collagen is a strong fiber, right? It makes tendons and ligaments, joint capsules. You find a lot of collagen in your skin, so your skin is pretty tough, right? The dermis is pretty tough, so collagen is tough. So we got reticular, we got collagen, it's tough. There's one more. Elastic. That's a stretchy kind, right? So it doesn't resist tension. You can stretch it, and then if you let go, what happens? It goes back to where it was, right? And then reticular is the third one, which is, in terms of strength, what can you tell me about reticular fibers? They're really, really weak. They're not strong at all, right? You can't stretch them. If you stretch them, they will stretch, but they'll snap, right? And they certainly won't go back together. So here is a cross-section of the spleen. It only has reticular fibers, right? So the spleen is very susceptible to trauma. Any kind of accident, the spleen can rip. And it's loaded with blood vessels, and actually blood is percolating through all these different spaces right here. So if the spleen is damaged, it's going to hemorrhage profusely. And since it only has reticular fibers, unlike your dermis, you can't put a suture in it, because as soon as you place a suture, what's going to happen to the spleen? It's going to rip some more, which means it's going to bleed some more. And if you want to suture some more, you can, but it's just going to bleed some more. So the only treatment then is to remove that part of the damaged spleen, or actually maybe even remove the whole spleen when that happens. Okay, so we see red pulp right here. Blood is just percolating through these spaces right here in red pulp. So red pulp filters blood, and it's getting rid of old and damaged red blood cells and looking for foreign microorganisms. And then here is white pulp within the spleen, and the white pulp right here filters lymph. Right, and that's separate from red pulp right here. And the white pulp also can have germinal centers to help fight infection. So the the immune system can be activated from white pulp as well. All right, and since you have a lot of sinusoids that are filled with blood in the spleen, sometimes we say that the spleen can act as a reservoir of red blood cells. If all of a sudden you cut yourself and hemorrhage, then these cells then can be pumped into your circulatory system and kind of make up for the red blood cells that have run out of your body for a short period of time. So somebody that's missing a spleen, I suppose, could be a little bit more sensitive to hemorrhage, right, if they have a massive hemorrhage, but I've never really heard of that being important. But I haven't spent a whole lot of time in an emergency room, so that's a good thing, unless you're an emergency room doctor. Then it's probably a good thing that you spend a lot of time there. Okay, the thymus gland, located in the superior mediastinum, and its function is for maturation of T lymphocytes. What kind of lymphocyte was a T lymphocyte once again? Contact killer. Touch you, touch you, touch. There's a neat Star Trek episode. Anybody remember that neat Star Trek episode? Where the Enterprise came upon this new solar system, and it was a fairly advanced solar system. It had a really advanced planet around it, and the planet was very xenophobic. What does xenophobia mean? Doesn't like, it's afraid of outsiders. Didn't like other kinds of cultures or other kinds of living organisms. So it put up a big defensive shield around the whole planet, and the defensive shield was that as a spaceship approached the planet, the spaceship would be scanned for living organisms, and that information, I guess DNA information, would be transmitted back down to the planet, and the planet then would build robots. Okay, and the robots were built to look exactly like each of the individuals on the Enterprise. So one robot looked like Captain Kirk, and the other looked like Spock. And that robot could only kill one person. So if it was a Captain Kirk robot, who could the Captain Kirk robot kill? Only Captain Kirk. It could touch everybody else on the crew, but as soon as it touched Captain Kirk, then they both vaporize. So that was a contact killer, right? So it was pretty easy to defend because if there was a contact killer for you, then I would just have to get between you and the contact killer and you could never get killed. But it was sort of an interesting show, and I'm sure they got it from what? The immune system, knowing something about T lymphocytes. So you might go back and take a look at that episode if you haven't seen it already 20 times. All right, so that's it for lecture. Sign-in sheet is going around. Let me turn the lights on. Recorder looked like it behaved nicely.